Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Startopia Radio.
Welcome back to Startopia Radio. I'm Michael Lauer here in the studio with some very special guests today. Joining me, we have formerly from Snapfinger, the founder and CEO, we have Jim Garrett. And then later on in the show, we'll be visiting with none other than president of Bonds Cove, Mr. Ed Trimble. How are you guys both doing today?
Great.
Doing great.
So we'll start off with you today, Jim. Tell me a little bit about the process of founding Snapfinger and what that was, and then we'll kind of go into what brings you here today.
Yeah. Well, the way we got started, Snapfinger, is I actually had a boutique venture firm that was investing in technology-based companies, and we saw a void in the marketplace, particularly serving the restaurant industry, where the restaurant industry had not really embraced a lot of the mobile and internet technology to create a better guest experience, particularly in the area of takeout delivery. And so essentially what we did was create a platform and a technology that would allow restaurants to be able to take advantage of the same type of internet opportunities that people like Amazon and Apple were taking on. And so we created a platform that was fully integrated into their existing point of sale systems that would allow consumers to place orders for takeout online or from their mobile device. So
is this like my Deliver Domino's, I can see where my delivery guy is kind of thing, or updates, is that kind of thought process?
Yeah, it's part of the same type of technology. So we empowered about 80% of the restaurant industry, companies like California Pizza Kitchen, Outback, Subway, Taco Bell, Burger King.
Sure, so some pretty big names there.
Yeah, a few.
So this was so successful that someone actually bought you guys out, correct? Which was the goal, right?
Right.
So explain to me that process and kind of how that went down.
Well, you know, it took a while. I mean, a lot of people nowadays think you can kind of do this overnight, but we had been around for...
Wait, you weren't an overnight success story?
No.
Do those even exist?
We were an overnight failure is more like it. It took several times trying to figure out what not to do, but, you know, we went through a period of about 8 years, raised money through both private individuals as well as a venture capital firm. There came a point where the venture firm put a significant amount of money in us to launch a consumer platform, very similar to some people may know of Grubhub today that
sure.
just went public. So we actually had an opportunity to buy Grubhub several years ago for less than $2 million because they couldn't quite figure it out. Obviously, they did. And built a very successful business. But our venture firm wanted us to really go after that direct-to-consumer model and basically create a platform in which to do that. Previously, we had focused primarily on developing white-labeled type technology applications for the brands themselves. So we empowered many of the brand sites or many of the brands' mobile applications where you go direct to the restaurant brand and have focused primarily on national chains, whereas what the strategy that the VCs wanted us to pursue was a direct-to-consumer strategy. While we did a great job on the side of technology and on the side of acquiring restaurants, we just really didn't have the consumer marketing DNA to be successful at that. So quite frankly, what happened over a period of 2 years, we pretty much spent all the money that the VCs put in and didn't have a whole lot to show for it.
Sure.
So at that point, the way the VC community works is, you know, they don't want to go back to their partners and say, well, we failed and we need to put more money in for a pivot. And so we started looking for alternative, you know, options of how to refocus the business. And so what I did was put together a group of investors to actually buy out the VCs, which is kind of unusual. But I sort of had a network that would allow me to do that. once that happened, we got the company back on plane, and we were doing very well in the core business that we initially intended to focus
on. Which wasn't anyway. Consumer-based?
It was Which was not necessarily shift. Consumer-based. It was back to being more of a B2B play, a SaaS-based model.
Sure. Well, that's an important point, though. I want to kind of hone in on that for startups listening or people who are gearing up to take some venture capitalist money. Once that happens, they kind of call some shots there that you don't really maybe not want to have called. Yeah. And it may not be in the best interest of the company, right?
Yeah, in most cases, the VCs really have a strong position. In our particular case, and I won't bore people with the details, we managed to not allow that to happen to us. But they did have a strong position on the board and strong voting rights. So we could have made it very uncomfortable for each other, quite frankly. So it was in everyone's best interest to figure out how do we play fair and proceed. But yes, most of the time, you know, when you bring in a VC, you know, they are going to pretty much control the outcome of what takes place because they usually have a preferred position. They have a certain number of votes and board presence that allows them to do that. And frankly, rightfully so. I mean, you know, they're putting in a lot of capital and they're counting on the management team to execute. In this case, we were not able to execute. And so instead of just, you know, winding the business down, we felt we still had a strong business, but not necessarily in the area of focus that they were most interested in. And we all knew that the consumer play had a much bigger upside. And we did some things right, but at the end of the day, we just didn't have the right marketing DNA for a consumer platform. And quite frankly, we didn't have the right capital mix to
sure.
to aggressively pursue that. So, so for us, you know, by pivoting and sort of pulling back and then getting the VCs out, it allowed me to get the business back on plane and at least put it in a position for a nice exit. I mean, it didn't turn out to be a $1 billion IPO like Grubhub, but it was, you know, material and significant to our investors. But by being able to buy out the VCs, it turned out to be a great opportunity for the investors that came in late. And essentially, the timing was real good because we found ourselves in a situation with two or three companies at the same time very interested in us. And so I played those cards accordingly and did what I thought was best for our shareholders and ultimately, you know, provided an exit opportunity.
So what exactly was the exit opportunity for you guys?
Well, we had created an environment that became very interesting to both credit card processors, point-of-sale companies, as well as some private equity firms. And so based on the makeup of the investors and the amount of preferred investment and whatever, we felt like, you know, a successful exit for us was anything north of $30 million. And so what had happened is we actually got inquiries from three different companies within 2 or 3 weeks of each other. And that sort of got the process started. Ironically, what eventually took place was we didn't sell to any one of those three companies. as we started the process, I saw a window of opportunity, and so I made a phone call to a lady who had also invested in a company that I had invested early into before we started Snapfinger. It was a group of investors. They had five or six VCs in this company called Emanate, E-M-N-8, out of San Diego. And they had invested well over $100 million in that company over the past 10 years. So The primary investor at this point was Sid Bass out of Dallas, Texas. And knowing how committed they were to the industry, I called her up and I said, look, obviously you guys are very committed or you wouldn't have invested as much as you have to this point.
Quite a few zeros on the end of that check, yeah.
And by the way, has continued to invest heavily.
Sure.
Very much believing in the vision. And so I said, you know, we've got three companies that would like to acquire us, but quite frankly, if we sell, we'll essentially just become a utility within their portfolio of offerings. And I really wanted an opportunity to see the vision played out. And so so I put in a phone call to her, and we met, and it was very clear that we were very much in alignment in terms of the vision and the opportunity that we saw before us. And she made a lot of things happen very quickly and went to their board and presented this opportunity. They came to the table and acquired us. Probably from our first meeting to the close was probably less than 60 days.
That's pretty quick.
Which is pretty fast.
Yeah.
But they had to move fast because we had other parties interested,
right,
and my fiduciary responsibility is to all the shareholders.
Which gave you a pretty good position, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that really accelerated things, and so what they wound up doing was they acquired us and then ultimately merged us with the company that they had invested so heavily in over the past several years. We represented, once they merged those two companies, we represented about 90% of the revenue and probably 80% of the customer base.
They had
really kind of struggled with finding their place. Had some really talented people and some really good technology, and quite frankly, had a much more of a marketing bent than we had, but had played in a slightly different area of both technology and the restaurant industry. So they bought us and then merged us together with them and formed a new company called Tilster, and which is the company that exists today. So it turned out to be a great exit for our investors, a great opportunity for our employees, and quite frankly, it has really benefited our customers because it broadened the scope of our capabilities to bring
sure.
to them.
Right. Well, I want to shift gears here. Jim, we're going to come back to you in a minute. We have some questions for both you and Ed at the same time. But I want to shift to Ed here and talk a little bit about Bonds Cove and what you guys are doing for folks.
Yeah, so Bonds Cove is a digital consultancy that I actually started this year. I've been in the Atlanta tech community space for the past 20 years, and I guess I've gotten comfortable with the tag of serial entrepreneur, finally, with the companies I've founded. One of the businesses that I may be best known for around town was EasyGov. It was an e-government solutions company that we started in 1999 and ultimately exited in 2009. So I've been in the Atlanta community, in the internet software tech space for
sure.
a long time now. And had the good fortune, the opportunity to take some time off earlier this year, a sabbatical of sorts.
That is nice to have that option.
Yeah, I got to spend some time with the family and
That's awesome.
Work on some personal projects. And so coming out of that time, I was really recharged and refreshed, and Bonds Cove is the consultancy that we formed to work with companies, both very large, Fortune 500, all the way down to some startups we're working with. Focused on new trends in innovation and the opportunities, the challenges and the opportunities that creates for enterprises. So, for example, trends that we're focused on and really excited about, obviously mobile.
Yeah, it's a big one, right?
I mean, you know, this is not a new trend, but it's
no, but it's becoming more of a bigger trend as well.
It's an explosion that we're right in the middle of. If you look at the numbers, you're seeing 60, 70, 80% year-over-year growth in usage of mobile apps, in mobile advertising. I mean, these numbers are staggering when you realize how quickly the world is embracing and adopting not mobile for voice, but mobile for data and mobile for day-to-day applications. And so that's creating all kinds of threats for larger companies, opportunities for larger companies, certainly opportunities for smaller companies. So we're really focused on the mobile space.
How to incorporate it effectively, kind of that kind of, not making it just doing it to do it, but make it strategic kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, you're going to have, and we have had the early adopters, the early pioneers, you hear them called, that
sure.
are experimenting kind of in the sandbox with new mobile applications. And that's been going on for years. But you're starting to see more and more very strategic, big dollar investments, big bets that larger companies are making. And you're seeing these, you know, dramatically successful startup emerging technology companies whose whole businesses are built on mobile and run on mobile. And then some other trends that I'm particularly interested in, that the you'll hear it called the trust economy, the sharing economy, peer-to-peer marketplaces, what's happening with Airbnb and Lyft and TaskRabbit and some of these companies that have, you know, literally just exploded in the past few years. And, you know, it's more than just the technology. The technology enables that, but it's really kind of this sociological phenomenon taking place where, you know, people are comfortable doing business and transactions with their neighbors. And it's creating this whole new economy that didn't exist, you know, 5 to 10 years ago. And so you see statistics like Airbnb doubling its number of rooms every year. It's, I think, 550,000 listings today, and is soon going to surpass, you know, the Hiltons and the Intercontinentals of the world in terms of, you know, the amount of inventory that they have on the market. And so what's fueling that, and what does that mean for the future here? And there was recently an article by David Brooks that talked about how part of what's happening here with these businesses is that the middle class is still feeling squeezed in this economy, and they're looking for deals, essentially. He didn't use those words. Those are my words. But they're, you know, they're not willing to pay full rack rate, you know, at a hotel. They're not willing to pay full rate for a rental car or for a taxi cab. And so that has enabled, you know, the Lyfts and the TaskRabbits and the Airbnbs to emerge and kind of create and enable this trend that's taking place. So Bonds Cove is, you know, we're focused on these dramatic kind of emerging trends in digital and particularly internet software, where my background has been.
Sure.
And working with large and small companies to capitalize on that.
Right. Now, there are a lot of shiny objects in the tech field, things that are new and exciting, and maybe some of your clients want to use them, but it's not the best thing for them. How do you talk them off the ledge and steer them towards something else or find a way to incorporate it? What's the balance there?
Yeah, so I, you know, when I talk to companies about this, my position is usually you don't want to be first.
Yeah,
okay? You don't
right.
want to be first, but when you see maybe a competitor and maybe an analogous, you know, situation in a parallel space or industry, and you see the opportunity and the opportunity is being proven out, you want to be a fast follower. Now with startup companies, it's very different. You know, typically you are chasing
the
shiny
pig.
Object.
Right.
Right. I mean, typically you are, because that's where the opportunity is. So it really kind of depends on what seat you're sitting in. Are you the chief strategy officer, chief revenue officer for a Fortune 500 company, or are you a smaller company looking to, you know, to have an impact with your new business?
So you must do a lot of dissecting too, right? I mean, you got to figure out not only what the problem is, but how to fix it and why things are happening. You mentioned how those challenges can be different based on the size of the company. We're focused on startups here. What are some unique challenges that startups face that maybe Fortune 500 companies don't?
Well, I've started now five companies from the ground up.
Sure.
In my life. So I know this all too well. I've got the scars to prove it. I've had just as much challenge and failure as I have success. So I've been on both sides of that, and you gotta have thick skin as an entrepreneur.
Right.
It's a, you know, you want to find an opportunity, A, that you're passionate about, B, where there's typically a big opportunity.
Right.
You know, I challenge entrepreneurs who come to me and paint a picture of an opportunity, a business opportunity that's not in the hundreds of millions of dollars market size, because you know, you want to chase after something big. You're not going to capture the whole market. You're going to get a small slice of the market. So the bigger the market, the better. With entrepreneurs, I think it's you're trying to align a number of things simultaneously. You're trying to bring a product up. You're trying to bring sales and marketing function up. That's typically the founder or the founding team. You're trying to bring in capital that will enable all of this. And so, you know, it takes a unique individual, I think, to bring a company, build a company from the ground up, to be able to align all those resources, bring them along together to create a successful company.
Sure. We're here with Ed Trimble from Bonds Cove and Jim Garrett, formerly from Snapfinger, now with Tilster. I want to kind of open it up a little bit here and talk more about how the startup scene and technology scene has changed over the past couple decades. You guys aren't strangers, neither of you are strangers to the startup scene and building companies and exiting them and failing and succeeding and doing it all over again multiple times. I want to start with you, Jim. How has the economy and the kind of ecosystem changed for startups over the past 10, 5, maybe, I don't know, how many years you think is a good sample size here?
Well, you know, I think the startup sort of world can be broken down into two areas, I think. One is lifestyle businesses, and one is, as he said, you know, really big opportunities. I mean, I'm the same way. If you can't show me in your business model how you, at least a strategy of how to get to 100 million, then you shouldn't be probably looking for outside capital. You should basically rely on, you know, friends, family, your own means, because you're going to create disappointment. And so, to me, what I've seen, you know, in terms of the startup world and changing, you know, we went through the wave of sort of instant success and people, you know, getting hyperactive over what I call minimal viable products that were brought to market that got a lot of attention, a lot of investment, and some of them succeeded and most of them failed. And then we went through a bad economy where everything got pulled back. And you saw less startups, but the ones that made it through that time were certainly more substantial. And building a company from scratch during that time was very, very difficult because you didn't have just silly money.
Right.
Interesting enough, it's the pendulum, I believe, is now swinging back to some silly money again. I mean, there's a lot of money that's been sort of pent up waiting on opportunities.
Kind of kept under the mattress for
a
while.
Yeah, and so I'm seeing more, you know, deals done that I think are somewhat questionable, at least for my appetite. But and I think, you know, there's you're seeing industries start to be broken down and morphed out, so that there's a lot of opportunities just within micro segments of businesses. So, and it's not just about, you know, a lot of people think it's about technology or it's about an idea. I can tell you right now, what the key is experience and management team. That's what people invest in. You know, ideas are a dime a dozen, and you can have great ideas, but there's a lot of people with great ideas, and there's a lot that's involved in patenting ideas and make sure you're not you know, infringing on patents. I can't tell you how many startups we see that come to us with something that they're really excited about, and what they didn't bother to do their research, that there's, you know, people that hold the patents on that idea. And what happens is they put a lot of time and energy into building it, only to find out that
it's been done before,
and now they're either going to be sued or whatever, and it becomes
right.
A nightmare that you put all this work and energy into something that you can't see materialize. So I think, to answer your question, you know, I think the startup world, I've seen it sort of go full circle, and I think the next few years will be interesting because, again, like I said, I don't think it's about just technology anymore. I think some of these folks that have some good ideas with technology probably need to seek out people who have a good business acumen, a good mature, experienced business acumen to help them vet out their ideas, to truly look at, you know, how are you going to generate revenue? Because at the end of the day, people invest because they expect a return.
Right.
And too often people get so caught up in what they're doing, they just want to talk about what they're doing and how they're doing it, but they can't really articulate how is this going to generate, you know, profits and money.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, that's what it's sure. about. You know, the Instagram stories of the world are few and far between.
There's lots of startup corpses on the road to that, right? So is this pretty much what you're finding as well?
Yeah, just a couple other things that I'll highlight. Someone was asking me the other day recently to compare today versus 1999 when I started my company, EasyGov. And, what was behind that question is, you know, what Jim was talking about. Is there a bubble happening right now? And are we going to, you know, experience a bursting bubble like we did in 2000, 2001? And there are parallels, I think, with what's going on today. I mean, you're seeing so much startup activity and more venture activity. You've seen this incredible five-year run in the NASDAQ. There's a lot of cash that's, you know, that's been on the sidelines, that's pent up, that's getting put to work. And so in a lot of ways, it feels like 1999. But I went back and did a little bit of research just to see kind of how those numbers lined up. And, you know, while we are seeing similar trends, it was on a scale that was much greater back in 1999. And a couple ones that jumped out at me, whereas the NASDAQ's been up 200% over the past 5 years, in 99 it had been up 500% in the prior 5 years.
Yeah.
And today we're seeing an increase in VC activity of kind of that 20 to 35% a year over year, which is very, very healthy, obviously. But from 99 to 2000, and then still from 2000 to 2001, you're seeing VC activity up 120%+ year over year in both those years. So, yes, we are seeing, you know, very healthy.
Sure. It's healthy, but it's not getting too big to where the point where it's
well, I hope
crazy.
Not.
Well, yeah. is it kind of increasing? Is that percentage increasing, or is it kind of just kind of going 20-20?
You know, the numbers that I saw, it's a much healthier, more sustainable trend line than what you saw back in 99 and 2000.
And do we learn from that mistake, or is there other factors involved that kind of you think kind of quelled that?
I don't think it was so long ago that folks don't have that. That's not imprinted in their memory. Okay, the 22, 23-year-old entrepreneur, maybe not. Sure. Guys like me and Jim and all the VCs that are still out there funding these businesses, we remember those days pretty well. And, you know, back then when we got EasyGov funded, we had a $20 million valuation with a business plan and a 9-person startup team. We had no product. We had no – we actually did have a
right.
customer. But, you know, those days are long gone. And the days of getting these, you know, valuations, incredible valuations based on eyeballs or
sure.
the prediction of eyeballs, those days are long gone. And so, you know, I think we did learn a lot from that time. And I think the entrepreneurs and the VCs and everyone's involved in startups today are a lot more focused a lot earlier on revenue.
Results,
the path to profitability.
Sure. So in the past, you're saying it was more of like, yeah, this is a good idea. This, in theory, this should work. I'll give them my money. Now it's, hey, is it working? You have to have some proven track record before you can get funding now for a startup. Or you can't just say, yeah, this is my idea. This is our plan. On paper, it looks great. But you have to have some runway, right?
Yeah, and that kind of points to the other change I want to highlight, which is the amount of capital that you need today, and I'm speaking specifically about software businesses,
okay.
not internet software business, the amount of capital that you need to really prove out a business idea and to get to a pilot and a first customer and some initial revenue is much, much lower than it was 15, 20 years because of the tools and technology. So
cost has gone down, right?
Yeah. Just a quick example, with EasyGov, we put governments online around the world to do things like pay their taxes and parking tickets and register their car, et cetera. And we built our own payment engine, and we literally spent thousands of hours probably building out this payment engine, something that you can turn on in an hour today with a product like Stripe. So you have all this infrastructure, all these tools and technologies that you get out of the box that allows your engineering team to be lean and to move very quickly and to get to a product to market much more quickly and to to either succeed or to fail in a much shorter period of time with much less capital. And that's a very good thing.
We're here with Jim Garrett and Ed Drimbel on Startopia Radio. I want to pose this question to you guys. So how is Atlanta unique as far as this technology startup? I know we have Georgia Tech right here and some great tools. Is it the new Silicon Valley, or what's going on here with Atlanta, Jim?
Well, from my perspective, and I'm unique in that I'm a native of Atlanta, so I've watched it grow. I think what Atlanta offers that no one else does is such a diverse strong corporate environment that becomes sort of open hunting ground for startup companies to approach companies like UPS and Coca-Cola and Delta and Home Depot and on and on and on. You know, within these companies, they have needs, and they, you know, those needs can oftentimes be fulfilled by companies that are more aware of what's going on there. I think so. That's one thing. I mean, and I think the thing that currently holds us back compared to Silicon Valley, oddly enough, in California, they allowed government pension funds to be invested in the VC community. And because of that, it just fueled the fire out there. And because those are huge dollars that get reinvested in the communities. And so, whereas here, we really don't have, and anybody who tells you Atlanta has a VC market or stability, they're just wrong. We just simply don't. We have a few people that sort of, you know, play at it. But the truth is, we're light years from being a healthy VC community like Silicon Valley. We're starting to see, you know, some of that change with people who have been successful and trying to pour back in to the community. But that's the thing in my mind that is missing now. We've got there's plenty of talent. There's plenty of great companies that, you know, breed people who can spin off ideas, you know, out of companies like CheckFree and others, you know, large companies, medium-sized companies, a lot of talent between, you know, Georgia Tech, university system. But what's missing is just sort of, you know, that you know, Sand Hill Road, where you can go and meet with 70 different VC companies and get your ideas, you know, put forward.
I'll pile on with Jim. With the pension funds, we were actually the last state in the union. We were the 50th state in the union to allow our pension funds to make investments in alternative investments. And part of those alternative investments are our local companies in Georgia. We did get that approved. We now have an Invest Georgia fund, and we have a path to put money to work in our local companies. But the money's not flowing yet, and we're not doing it. And, you know, Jim made a great point about California, and plenty of other states have gotten behind, you know, their startup community, early stage community with dollars in ways that we haven't. But there are so many positive things about Georgia, about Atlanta, and you know, Jim touched on the universities. I mean, Georgia Tech is one of the largest and very best engineering schools in the country, and it's right here in the heart of the city. We're also very attractive to young, highly educated graduates. So if you see some of this data that comes out on where are these newly minted highly educated graduates moving to Atlanta, is always at the very top of the list, one or two on the list. So we're very attractive because of our affordability, the weather, our airport. Young people love this city, and that's great for our technology community. And you know, the other thing is we have some things that we do very, very well. I mean, Silicon Valley, we're never going to be the consumer internet success story that Silicon Valley is, probably anywhere close to that. But when you look at internet security, when you look at fintech, Jim mentioned CheckFree earlier, when you look at healthcare IT, when you look at marketing software with the SilverPops and the Pardots of the world, and we've had a number of success stories here the past couple of years, we've got some pockets of innovation that we do really, really well, maybe better than any place in the country. And so You know, and a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about this, and there are lots of efforts going on to do this. But let's highlight the things that we do well, and let's really promote those areas of innovation where the city and the state is strong.
So where's the greatest area of improvement, or where you see an improvement trend kind of happening for Atlanta? Where's the pendulum swinging the hardest? Is it in the what's being invested? Is it the types of things that are being created? Where's the greatest change needed?
Well,
right now,
I see, just real quickly, I see some really encouraging things in terms of the let's call them entrepreneurship centers, and you know, we've had the ATDC here, ATDC, which has been a phenomenal success story. I wish it were bigger. I wish there were even more money pouring into it. I wish there were five times as many companies, but there are a lot of great people doing a lot of great work there. And then we have, you know, some new ones forming around the city, and the you know, probably the best example, the highest profile example, is the Atlantic Village in Buckhead. David Cummings, it's a single individual, a friend of mine, who's really single-handedly brought that out of the ground and now has, you know, more than 100 companies in there, a wonderful success story. So I think this density of startup activity and bringing the companies together and all the good things that come out of that in terms of serendipitous interactions and you know, people learning from each other and having a place to go as a one-person, two-person, five-person startup where you can really, you know, make more progress more quickly with your business.
You find that pretty much the same thing?
Yeah, you know, when I think about Atlanta, and of course being a native and being somebody that's loved this state and this town, you know, one of the things I've looked at is trends in terms of where there's opportunity developing in this state. So, for example, Georgia is the number one state in the country for women-owned businesses. So we have a lot of opportunity here for women to break out and into the entrepreneurial world, and there's a lot of things that are being done to help make that happen, organizations and a lot of creativity going there. We're one of the top, you know, three states in the country for producing movies because our government has made that an attractive opportunity through tax credits and things such as that. You know, the University of Georgia started this program a couple of years ago, the Bulldog 100, where they map out the top 100 startup companies from graduates from the University of Georgia all over the world. So they're starting, you know, to pay attention to that. So I think there are a lot of reasons to be excited about what's going on here and the environment. As he mentioned, the Tech Village is a great opportunity. But somehow or another, we as entrepreneurs and guys that have exited, we've got to do a better job of organizing ourselves to help foster that and to bring in, you know, VCs, not just for their money, but the things that sometimes VCs bring to the table is they have a perspective and a broader understanding of the competitive environment that will that force, you know, startups to really think through their strategy, their model, is this going to be successful, and how to go about doing it. So that's a little bit what's missing here, and I'd love to see us start to pull on some of the previous very successful people in this town, bring them together, and really foster that.
Sure. We're here with Jim Garrett and Ed Trimble on Startopia Radio. The question I always like to ask, especially the more seasoned entrepreneurs, since we have so many startups listening to the show, and typically they're going through a lot of failures and some tough times, I'd like for you each to share your biggest failure and what you learned from that experience. And we'll start with you, Ed.
Okay. So I started a company, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago now, and it was called Endorse for a Cause. And it was a business where I, you know, a for-profit business, but it had a nonprofit mindset and was all about promoting social causes. So the idea, which is still love the idea very much, and it's getting some traction out there, with Facebook Causes and some other startups was that someone could recommend products to friends online through Twitter, through Facebook, through social media. And if their friends purchased the product, part of that sale could get directed to your favorite charity. So that may be Children's Healthcare here in Atlanta. Could be the American Cancer Society. We went out and signed up more than 20 of, I think, the largest 40 nonprofits to get behind and to support Endorse for a Cause. Business didn't work, I think, really for a couple of reasons. One is that Facebook changed their algorithm so that these recommendations that were flowing out of Endorse for a Cause suddenly weren't in people's streams, daily streams. They were getting segmented out as, you know, as corporate messages, spam, even though they were being directed by individuals to their friends. And that really hurt the business, because suddenly these recommendations, the visibility went almost to zero and people weren't clicking through and weren't buying products. And so a lesson there was to be really careful about building a business that has a major dependency on other businesses.
That you have no control over.
That you have no control over. And, you know, and there's a lot of that happening, you know, out there today. You have these large businesses. Facebook is one. LinkedIn is another in the business world, where they have this, you know, massive database that a lot of companies, kind of a cottage industry of companies, have started up leveraging that data. You have to be really careful. And that hurt Endorse for a Cause and hurt the business. The second lesson that I took away from that is, I think it was a little naive of me to try and combine my, or maybe idealistic's a better word, to combine my, you know, nonprofit aspirations, interest with with my for-profit business. And so after that, after Endorse for a Cause, I've kept those two separate. They're both really important to me.
Right.
I spend a lot of time on both, but I haven't tried to combine them again into a single business. But everything I've done, whether it's been successful or has not been, like Endorse for a Cause, has been an incredible, you know, learning experience.
Right.
And you know, kind of hear that, and it seems like a little bit of a cliche, but you truly do, I think, learn just as much, if not more, from your failures, things that didn't work, as things that do work.
For you, Jim?
Well, you know, I think success is all about just overcoming failures along the way. You know, as a business, I mean, I've started three or four, and probably the first one I started back in the 80s was a concept called YouthPlex. And what YouthPlex was intended to be was a youth-centered sports, fitness, and training facility for kids, where you join a membership. And we actually had Nautilus design equipment just for kids, and it had gymnastics, and it had all kind of stuff. And it was intended to be a place for, you know, after-school kids to be able to be productive, and probably an upscale boys club, girls club type thing that was in suburban in Atlanta. And then we started franchising it way too early, before we'd really proven out our model. And I, you know, look back on it, there were just some flawed assumptions. And so that's one of the cautions I would give entrepreneurs today, is it's easy to get excited about an idea or a product or a technology, and you very quickly discount, as you talk to people about it, you oftentimes discount sort of their objections, and you go, oh, well, you know, we'll overcome that because, or that's not an issue because. And I would caution you to really pay attention to those trends of cautions that people and that you get advice from. Don't just sort of blow them off and go, well, they don't really understand, I've got a solution for that. You know, there's a predetermined destination to pretty much every path. And so you have to really focus on being honest with yourself, being willing to walk away and saying, you know, I've taken this to this point, and my due diligence tells me that this is flawed. It's funny, because you borderline, you know, entrepreneurs borderline between, you know, crazy and successful. I mean, you literally.
It's a fine line, yeah.
In fact, I tell people, really smart people have have real challenges at starting a business because they're too smart. They're too risk averse. They can tell you 900 reasons why it won't work. And most of those are right. Entrepreneurs somewhat have this blind faith that, you know, I'm just going to muscle through it. Or I've learned that I'm not the smartest guy in the class, but I'll outwork everybody. So I'll just push this through. And many times that's what leads to your success. But I think that, you know, the thing that I've learned is pay attention to what people say. I mean, a VC guy one time told me something very interesting. And it was hard to accept at the time. But I look back on it, and as much as I hate to say it, he was right. He said, if a VC won't invest in your company, then you shouldn't either. And what he was basically saying is, this is what we do for a living. All right. I look at and evaluate hundreds of companies. I know markets. I know industries. I know technology. I know management teams. I know leadership. And as compared to all those that I've looked at, I'm not interested in yours. Then he said, then you shouldn't be. Because your time is the most valuable thing. And what's really hard is you can wind up hanging in there. You can reduce your cost of living and you can do all kind of things. And all of a sudden you wake up one day and you've invested 5 years in something that really has not much upside potential. So I go back to what he said earlier, which is really make sure the market you're going after and the opportunity you're going after is big, because you're going to need big to make up for, you know, the time lost, yeah. and everything else. So that if you become marginally successful, it's financially viable. That's what you got to look at. And so, you know, but you know, failure is not a bad thing. We all learn from failures. And there is this, it's interesting as I talk to some young entrepreneurs, they don't see much of that. You know, the things they read about and hear about and see on the internet are sort of, you know, mix a little of part A and part B, and all of a sudden you have a successful company. It's not at all like that. And, and you know, today, VC firms, they really do invest in management teams more so than anything else. So they would be much more likely to invest in an idea that the two of us come up with, whether or not we've proven it or not, just because we've had some track record,
right?
That says, look, we may be wrong here, but we'll figure it out. And that's a lot of what they look for. So I would just encourage you, if you're out there today looking to do something, surround yourself with good, talented people that know what they're doing in the space that you're talking about. And don't think that, wow, I came up with this idea that nobody else has thought of. And I can guarantee you somebody has thought of it, and somebody's probably working on it. And so all that means is you probably don't know as much about that industry as you think you do. So just do your homework.
Just building on that that message to listen to the VCs, some advice I always give to young entrepreneurs is to listen to your customers very early on. So I've tried with my businesses, and I really encourage young entrepreneurs to find that first customer, to find that pilot, if you will, even before they have a product. Now, this is different depending on whether you're building a business for consumers or businesses. Maybe it's more relevant in B2B. But, you know, it's the inherent message there is that you need to be flexible and able to adapt to what the market is telling you. And you want to find market fit, market viability as quickly as possible. So you burn as few of your resources as possible to get there. And the way you get there is not, you know, sitting in an ivory tower, you know, three programmers on your MacBooks banging away for 3 months, right? You get out there and you talk to the market. You talk to your customers. You talk to VCs. You talk to people who've built similar businesses. You learn from that. And you recognize that whatever your idea was, whatever product you or service you were going to offer initially, it's going to morph. It's going to evolve. And you need to let the market take you to where you want to be as quickly as possible, and not invest all this time, build your perfect product in your mind, take it to market, and realize it's not right. It doesn't fit. Yeah. You're out of money. you know, and you can't go forward. So
sure.
Find those customers, find those champions, find those pilots early on as you get your business off the ground.
So unfortunately, we got to start wrapping up here. Where can folks go to learn more about UGEM and about Tilster?
Well, they can go to tilster.com, or they can look at my LinkedIn site. Tilster.com is probably the best.
Sure. And Ed?
Bondscove.com or LinkedIn, or they can follow me on Twitter at Ed Trimble.
Well, thanks for both joining me on the show today. It's been
a
great conversation.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it. I'm Michael Lauer here for Startopia Radio. We'll see you next time.